Introduction 0.0.
Détente. The copyright wars are nothing new. 500 years ago, Europe was convulsed by a struggle over who could access the Bible and under what circumstances. Canterbury and Rome spent decades battling over whether the uncertain benefits of broad access to Scripture were worth diminishing the undeniable majesty of their incumbent religious institutions. A few hundred years later, at the turn of the 20th century, composers were forced to defend their own turf. They called performers pirates and insisted that recording music was a form of theft. John Philip Sousa, the great American composer, thought the record player would make musicians extinct. "Today, you hear these infernal machines going night and day," he said in 1906 while testifying before Congress. "We will not have a vocal cord left. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape." A few decades after that, the record men were struggling with their own challengers. In the 1930s, ASCAP, the organization that licensed mainstream recording artists' broadcast rights to radio, raised its fees by nearly 500%. The radio stations responded by boycotting ASCAP. That meant that ASCAP artists didn't get played on the radio. Instead, within a few years, the stations turned to another, newer artists' organization, BMI, which had been created to represent race artists and hillbilly music. For much of 1941, the genres that ASCAP had neglected were all that was played on the radio, and so only those upstarts saw a dime. After 10 months of this, ASCAP's artists rebelled. Why should these other musicians, whose legitimacy ASCAP didn't even want to acknowledge, get a never-ending payday while they starved? ASCAP backed down on its fee increases, and the most important principle in the copyright wars was affirmed: money talks and bullshit walks. If you want to attain fame and fortune as a creative person, you're probably like I was when I started out, a harried, busy individual trying to squeeze in time to make art around the constraints of a day job and family. You don't want to hear about the copyright wars. You certainly don't want to fight in them. You want to make stuff and, ideally, get paid for it. I'm with you. This is a book about the reality today of the internet and the regulations that surround it, and the ways that those regulations shape successful strategies for earning a creative wage. It is also a book about the profound pitfalls that both creators, writers, musicians, filmmakers, painters, and their investors, publishers, studios, record labels, fall prey to when it comes to getting their work out into the world. It's been more than 500 years since the copyright wars began, and they show no sign of abating. Peace in our time seems unlikely. If you want to make stuff and try to earn a living from it rather than shaking your fist and telling the internet to get off your lawn, then this is the book for you. Creators, investors, intermediaries, and audiences. When we're talking about copyright, we're fundamentally talking about four different activities: making creative works, investing in creative works, distributing and selling creative works, and enjoying creative works. As a shorthand, I'll be using creator to describe people who make creative works: painters, photographers, game designers, novelists, poets, musicians, songwriters, choreographers, dancers, and many other sorts of people. I'll use investor to describe someone who puts capital, cash, into the production and refinement of that work. Think of a publisher, a record label, a studio. I'll use intermediary to describe those entities that handle the work between creation, investment, and delivery: a distributor, a website like YouTube, a retailer, an e-commerce site like Amazon, a cinema owner, a cable operator, a TV station or network. Finally, I'll use audience to describe the person the work ends up with. These are all fluid roles, of course. Some intermediaries, like cable operators, are also investors or creators. Some creators, like film directors, require investors before they can make anything. And some of the most dedicated audiences are made up of creators themselves, which is why authors are usually photographed standing in front of a wall of other people's books. Introduction 0.1. What makes money? There is no real secret to success in business. If you want to make as much money as possible, all you need to do is make something people are willing to pay for and offer it at a price they're willing to pay. Complaining about the universe's unfairness is never part of a successful strategy. Here are some other things that don't make money: complaining about piracy, calling your customers thieves, treating your customers like thieves. A common refrain about entertainment and business in the news today is how much money all those investors and creators could be making if only the internet and its users would start behaving themselves. If you've already made a cool couple billion in the old world, have plenty left in the bank, and want to take a gamble on getting your buddies in Congress to pass laws to suit your needs, this kind of complaining might seem like a winning strategy. But if you want to start earning a creative living now, you can't play by those rules. Wouldn't it be nice to come up with a way of making money that works on the internet we have today instead of the one that Hollywood is betting on creating tomorrow? Money on the table. When a creator tries to make money, she becomes an entrepreneur, a business person. Business people are prone to all sorts of madness. Succeeding in business requires that you avoid this madness. One particular strain of madness is the overwhelming, irrational concern that you might be letting someone benefit from your work for free, what an economist would call aversion to positive externalities. In plain English, that's worrying that someone else is getting some benefit from your investment of labor or capital. It's a bit like worrying that lost strangers are reading their street maps using the extra light from your porch as you sit out reading on a warm night. If you're paying for the light, why should they reap the benefit? If you can figure out a way to set up a service selling porch light, you might be onto something. But if you find yourself resorting to angrily switching off the light every time someone gets too close to your house, you're not going to have a very pleasant night. When it comes to policing your externalities, a little goes a long way. Jam tomorrow. My grandmother grew up in Leningrad in the former Soviet Union and is a wellspring of dour sayings from the old country. One of my favorites is, jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, no jam today. That is, we used to have jam before everything changed, and we're told there will be even more jam in the future. But right now, there is no jam. Or, don't tell me about pie in the sky when I die. I'm hungry now. Introduction 0.2. Don't quit your day job. Really. Being an entrepreneur is a gamble. 66% of all new businesses fail in the first 4 years, and that's across all sectors, from import-export to running a restaurant, to starting a babysitting service or an e-commerce site. Creative businesses are even more risky because the reasons we make art are fundamentally different from the reasons we undertake other kinds of commercial activity. You might, from childhood, nurse a dream of being a restaurateur, but if you looked around and found that your city was full of failing restaurants whose owners were going bust, you'd probably pick another career. In the creative arts, though, the lack of any reasonable marketplace for one's product is rarely a good enough reason to give up on it. Look at poetry, to name just one field. There was never much of a market for poetry, and today the market is as bad as ever. There's practically no commercial poetry. But today, more poetry is being written than ever before. People spend real folding money to learn to write better poetry. They devote hours and days and weeks of their lives to it. They are driven by it. In many cases, they can't stop. Humans seem to make art reflexively. Small children sing songs, make drawings, and tell stories long before they're exposed to the idea of money, markets, or remuneration. People working through trauma and depression have been rehabilitated by art therapists, teaching them to express themselves artistically. There is something inherently non-market about making art. It's something that economists would call irrational, and that the work artists put into their craft exceeds any reasonable expectation of profit or even a break-even return. I put my first short story in the mail when I was 16. I sold my first short story a year later to a little market, one that didn't pay professional rates. 10 years later, I made my first sale to a market that qualified as professional by the lights of the Science Fiction Writers of America, paying something like 4 cents a word. 5 years after that, my first novel came out, for which I received a little more than $7,000. I was 31, and 15 years had gone by between my first attempt to be a professional writer and my first published novel. 5 years after that, a full 20 years after I started trying to get paid to write, I quit my day job. But through it all, I couldn't stop. Seriously, if you'd broken all my fingers, I would have dictated my stories or written them with a pen clenched between my teeth. This doesn't mean it's always fun. My family knows that I can be a little irritable when I'm on a difficult deadline. I wrote a 120,000-word novel in the last 3 months of 2011, and it made me really grumpy, especially toward the end. Merry Christmas, now leave me alone, I'm on a deadline. But whatever personal flaws I exhibit when I'm working are as nothing compared with the absolute remorseless orneriness on exhibition when I'm not working. My interior world consists largely of thinking of books to write, writing books, recuperating from writing books, and then thinking of more books to write. In between, I write essays, speeches, novellas, novelettes, short stories, investigative journalism, columns, and blog posts. Lots of blog posts. I'm the co-editor and co-owner of a website called Boing Boing, and I've spent the past 10 years writing about 10 blog posts a day, every day. I often find myself unable to think about anything in any depth without writing a blog post about it to check whether I understand it sufficiently to convey it to someone else. I am compelled to write. Long before I wrote to keep myself fed and sheltered, I was writing to keep myself sane. Whatever kind of arts career you're hoping for, the odds are against you. This is a serious downer. Pretty much everyone who ever set out to earn a living or part of a living in the arts failed. Don't quit your day job isn't just a sarcastic barb to toss at your friends when they play their guitars at you. It's goddamned great advice, especially if you're hoping to support your family or save for your old age. When I set out to be a professional writer, filled with naive and downright weird ideas about what this was going to entail, I knew intellectually that I was probably not going to make it. On the other hand, I also knew that I was perfectly miserable when I wasn't writing, and that I yearned for widespread publication with all my heart. If you are like that, if you can't stop, and you are planning to try to earn a living off your art, then I want you to know some things about the internet. Because the marketplace for creative works today involves the internet, in ways large and small. You might be handcrafting one-of-a-kind sculptural assemblage birdhouses out of rusty license plates in your Unabomber shack in the middle of the woods, but chances are that you sell them through a site like Etsy. You might be recording a collection of all-acoustic roots music using instruments that predate the invention of piano rolls, but chances are you're going to start your research with Google, find your collaborators with Craigslist, and sell your music as MP3s. If you're setting out to earn a lot of money in the arts, your chances are slim. There are some artists who make it, for whatever definition of make it you favor. A tiny number become rich. A small number earn a good living. A slightly larger number earn a crappy living. And a respectable number earns something. But if you're setting out to earn a lot of money in the arts without regard to how internet regulation shapes the marketplace for creativity, your chances are zero. The single most important thing you need in order to have a career in the arts is persistence. The second most important thing you need is talent. The third most important thing is a grounding in how the online world works. It's that important. The goal of this book is to provide a first-of-its-kind look at the pitfalls and opportunities for earning a creative living in the age of the internet. I want to equip you with the critical skills required to have a non-zero chance of making a living as an artist today in the world as it is. Not the world as it was in the pre-internet era, and not in any of the tomorrows we've been promised. What I do on the internet, aka why listen to me? Why should you listen to what I have to say about the internet? Well, I may not be the world's geekiest artist. I hold out novelist Charles Stross or cartoonist Randall Monroe for this honor, but I am a pretty serious geek. I dropped out of university to be a computer programmer, co-founded a software company during the first dot-com boom, sold it, went to work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil rights organization that works on tech issues, helped build one of the most successful author-owned websites in the world, and pioneered electronic fiction distribution. I've been on the New York Times bestseller list twice. I've also released my novels and short story collections as free downloads simultaneously with their print editions. My last two novels have drawn mid-six-figure advances. I've won a long list of awards and been nominated for a longer list. I held an honorary PhD in computer science, and Boing Boing, the website I co-own, grosses several million dollars per year. I was a delegate to the United Nations World Intellectual Property Organization. I write columns and lecture pretty much everywhere, and every now and again I teach writers, prospective technologists, and even lawyers. If I'm wrong about how the internet works, it's not due to a lack of opportunity to learn or for having failed to think about it. If I'm wrong about how an artist's life works, it's not for a lack of making a living as one. And if I'm wrong about how copyright law interacts with the business of creativity, it's not for lack of experience with both. In short, if I'm wrong, I promise that I'll be wrong in a well-informed and interesting way.